My subject today is methodology, meaning, and the cognitive science of religion. Now, well, I've been interested in these problems for some time, and this particular talk was originally delivered as a keynote address at a conference on meaning, cognition and culture at Aarhus University at the end of May this year. And in that particular instance, I was primarily addressing people interested in the cognitive science of religion and trying to persuade them that philosophy was important. Today I shall engage in a slightly different activity, in that I shall try and persuade philosophers here that you ought to be interested in the cognitive science of religion. So, what the talk is about, it's about philosophical questions about methodology and meaning in the cognitive science of religion. Now, what I shall suggest is that these issues are important both for the cognitive science of religion and the philosophy of mind. One of the reasons they're important for the cognitive science of religion is that there's been a great deal of progress in the cognitive science of religion in terms of the empirical work that's been done. We know much more, we have much more data about the cognitive mechanisms that underpin and explain religious belief, both individually and collectively, than we ever did. But what is not so clear is whether we fully understand the significance of those results, in terms of providing an appropriate explanatory framework. I shall be discussing that in some detail. As regards the importance for the philosophy of mind, I believe that many centrally accepted claims in the philosophy of mind, much of what we might regard as orthodox philosophy of mind, is misguided. And it seems to me that the cognitive science of religion is very valuable because it provides us with an opportunity to see in a specific case and in relation to concrete data what the problems with some of those claims might be. So in other words, we take some of the theoretical argument about problematic issues in the philosophy of mind and actually take it into an empirical context where we've got some opportunity to put it up against the facts. So that's why I think philosophers should be interested in it. The central point of my talk, however, is that I will argue that problems about methodology and meaning are far more closely connected than many cognitive science of religion theories deem them to be. Now, what I mean by that is that many cognitive science of religion theories regard methodology and meaning as very separate questions. They say, here is methodology and here is meaning. And I think that this is a source of a lot of problems. What I shall suggest, using sort of Wittgensteinian grounds and Wittgensteinian thinking, is that methodology and meaning are fundamentally connected, and that our methodological commitments are not separate from what we think about meaning or what we should think about meaning. And a possible framework for thinking about these matters will be developed in due course. But that, I hope, sets the scene for where we are. So the next question I want to pursue about methodology is perhaps an obvious one. In what sense is the cognitive science of religion science? I mean, one of the assumptions when we say cognitive science is it's science. Now, the advent of cognitive science has blurred the natural and social science distinction. I mean, one of the things that has happened in the past is that the distinction between natural and social science was pretty clear. I think now it's become much less clear. But the importance of this is whether the cognitive science of religion is natural or social science bears on matters of methodology and meaning. It really does make a fundamental difference whether we think the cognitive science of religion is natural or social science, because that in turn is going to affect our commitments to methodology and meaning. One of the problems I think in the area is that a lot of the default position is that cognitive science is somehow some variant of natural science in a way that's not wholly explained or articulated. And I think this lack of clarity underpins a lot of the theories and a lot of the potential problems. What I shall suggest we need to do is to take what I call a properly scientific attitude rather than indulging in scientism. I mean, I think one of the problems that plagues this area and is also problematic within the philosophy of mind is the feeling that we ought to be properly scientific And there's such an insistence on that, that we move over from being appropriately scientific to indulging in scientism. What I shall suggest, which is controversial, is I shall suggest that explanations of religion in terms of purely individual cognitive processes are not scientific but scientism. And I will argue that many cognitive science of religion theories, in point of fact, do this. When I talk about cognitive science of religion theories, I don't have time to go into the details of what they are now, but they involve claims about the mechanisms that underpin religious cognition. For example, what sort of features, cultural representations that are propagated and transmitted have, what is the role of agent detection systems in generating supernatural agents, what is the relationship between the properties we attribute to supernatural agents and ordinary agents, and various other things. And there are all sorts of detailed explanations of that kind. But the majority of them in the field all start from the basis of individual cognitive processes. They say, here are the this is the explanatory basis for all these theories. Now, why this is problematic is that if you're looking at religion seriously, one thing that is clear about religion, apart from the fact it's a matter of individual belief, is it's a social practice. I mean, that is fundamental to any definition or understanding of religion. Mm-hmm. And therefore, any adequate theory is going to have to take that on board. What I'd like to address now is the question of why some of these ideas about explanation in terms of individual cognitive process and the cognitive science of religion have taken place. I think much philosophy involved in the cognitive science of religion has been imported wholesale from traditional philosophy of mind without due care being paid to its suitability. This, I think, is quite a common thing, because if you look at many disciplinary areas, it is a common thing to import philosophical ideas in. You simply sort of wheel them in blocks, and you know, people think, oh well, it looks reasonable, we'll have some of this and have some of that. And often they're not careful about whether it's really appropriate, and I do think that this is happening in the cognitive science of religion. And if you check the literature, you can clearly see that's the case, because I mean, there's reference to all sorts of things, you know, like the extended mind and other things, which is clearly come directly from the philosophy of mind. So what I still suggest is that the theoretical parameters for properly understanding the claims of the cognitive science of religion require scrutiny, so their empirical value is articulated and unhelpful metaphysics shown. So I think one of the things that does impede work in the cognitive science of religion is that we have a lot of, I think, unsatisfactory explanatory models and a lot of metaphysics. What I shall suggest is if we have better explanatory models, we can more fully articulate the value of the very good empirical work that's being done and get rid of a lot of the unhelpful metaphysics, which is actually impeding explanations. I mean, one of the problems with quite a few theories is that they have metaphysics built into them, and I'm not always sure the propagators of those theories are wholly aware of it. But of course, the problem then becomes that it's difficult to make progress, because what you do in terms of explicating metaphysics, the only thing that explicates metaphysics is more metaphysics. So what I still suggest is that the demarcation line between empirical findings and metaphysics needs investigation. The thing is, people assume in the cognitive science of religion, or many do, that they know what it is. But what I still suggest, you know, again, on Wittgensteinian ground, is that there's much hidden or covert metaphysics, and we need to bring that out and articulate it and become clear about what the demarcation between the two might be. So that's where I take the project and the work to be going. Now, what I want to talk about next is this whole sort of relation between explanation, description, explanation, reduction. Now, this is something I think reasonably well understood by philosophers, but again, causes much confusion, I think, in the cognitive science of religion. So I think we need to have a proper understanding of the nature and status of the claims of psychology and cognitive science. Now again, thinking in Wittgensteinian terms, we really do want to know what kind of a thing psychology is and what kind of a thing cognitive science is and what those claims really amount to. I mean, one of the problems is you mustn't take it as just being given. So one of the things that you do find is very prevalent in the cognitive science of religion is reductionist methodologies and theories. Now, one of the reasons that that is the case is that many people in the cognitive science of religion are actually anti-religious, strange as it may seem, and some of them clearly have it as their mission to put it, as they call it, to explain religion away. And they think a good way of doing that is to end up having some stronger reductionist methodologies and theories, that if you can really reduce lots of religious phenomena to something else, then you've explained them away, and then you've sorted the problem of religion out. So a lot of them do have that underlying agenda. And in many cases, some of them are engaged in very, very strong kinds of reduction. I mean, for some scholars, the objective is an explanation of religious phenomena in wholly cognitive and neurophysiological terms. So in this case, for some of the really hardline people, we're not just talking about individual cognitive process, we're actually talking right down to reduction at the neurophysiological level, and that includes things like qualia. So I have actually been at conferences where people have suggested that the ultimate goal of explaining religion should be to articulate it in terms of qualia. Now, I think that if you step outside the agenda, there's something clearly wrong with that. It's just not very plausible. However, such reductionist methodologies presuppose philosophically problematic ideas such as the mind-brain identity theory and a reductionist integrated causal model of science. So, in the background to a lot of this, there are many claims of that kind. And as I shall suggest, this is problematic because religion is fundamentally a collective and a social activity, and we need to do justice to that fact. Now, much reductionism taken from the philosophy of mind views itself as taking a properly scientific approach. But there are good reasons for disputing this view, particularly when questions of explanatory power are considered. Now, here I'm referring back to standard disputes about reductionism in the philosophy of mind. I think what motivates much reductionism is this idea that it's properly scientific, that in line with the model of natural science, if we could really reduce one thing to another thing and then to another thing, we would be engaging in proper science. The difficulty, of course, with much of the reduction that's propagated is whether it's really explanatory of anything. Because, I mean, you can postulate as much reduction as you want, but the question is, once you've done it, does it really help you with the explanation? I mean, if you were to say, you're thinking about, say, about religious cognitive phenomena, say, in terms of qualia, you see, you can say, well, okay, here we are, I reduce it to qualia in the brain. But then the problem is, once we have qualia in the brain, does that really explain what we set out to explain? It might be explaining something else, but it doesn't seem to be explaining what we originally wanted to know. And I think this is where a lot of the confusion comes from. Now, I think one of the things that's needed in thinking about the cognitive science of religion is we've got to be very clear about differences between the common confusion of description and explanation. Again, if you look at the cognitive science of religion literature, there are a lot of confusions about what is a description and what is an explanation. And being clear about the appropriate levels of description undermines much of the plausibility of reductionism. And again, here we've got a Wittgensteinian point, because if we are engaged in thinking, in articulating the value of empirical work, in many cases, all we really want is a good description. A good description does what we want it to do. If we've got that, we may not need a further level of explanation or reduction. And some of that involves recognising when we've described things appropriately. And also, as Wittgenstein says, when justification stops, when the spade turns, understanding the point at which it's not appropriate to be explaining things anymore. And in that sense, understanding more about descriptions and the purposes they serve, I think very usefully undermines the plausibility of much reductionism. Because in other words, if we can find the right descriptions in the right context, we don't need to engage in a lot of this heavy reductionism with all the attendant problems. So, next I want to address the question of Wittgenstein and scientific attitudes. I shall suggest that Wittgenstein provides pointers for how to approach questions of methodology and meaning. And in due course we'll talk about issues of privacy and also about social meaning. I now want to raise a much contentious question. Is it possible to be Wittgenstein without being anti-scientific? Now, many would claim if you are properly Wittgensteinian, you must be anti-scientific. Now, I shall suggest that you can be both Wittgensteinian without being anti-scientific. And I think this can be done if Wittgenstein is interpreted as making some significant claims rather than not being committed to any claims at all, as the strong therapeutic readings argue. So part of what underpins this is that at some point or other I'm suggesting that Wittgenstein does make some interesting claims and that he's not, and that he is saying something rather than nothing. And if that's the case, then I think we can raise the question, what could being Wittgensteinian without being anti-scientific amount to? I think that what we can say about this is that if we are properly Wittgensteinian, it doesn't mean we have to be anti-scientific. And indeed, I think a properly Wittgensteinian attitude in a number of cases certainly aligns with the empirical data that we do have. And I will attempt to outline how some of that looks a little bit later. To think about what being Wittgensteinian scientific might mean, well, one of the things that we ought to be committed to is removing metaphysics and armchair psychology as much as possible. I mean, one of the difficulties here, of course, is that it's very difficult to eliminate metaphysics wholly, because it seems in some cases that you do need some very minimal metaphysics to explain certain things. For example, you do want the ability to say compare propositions and facts, and although that doesn't sound like metaphysics, it actually is. So we'd ideally like to get rid of all of it, but we probably need to keep a bit of it. What I shall also say is important for Wittgenstein and scientific attitude is that we've got to get rid of certain problematic concepts, especially private objects, mental content and mental causation. This comes back to what I said earlier about much orthodox philosophy of mind being problematic. I think much of that has to go, but I think at the heart of it, the concern with privacy, content and causation are very, very problematic. And if you look at theories in the cognitive science of religion, you will find that many of them do involve those notions in various kinds of ways. Because once you keep talking about explanation in terms of individual cognitive processes, you're back in the whole territory of private objects, and you know what the content of such explanations might be, and indeed how one thing might cause another thing. Because if you want to explain a lot of these things, very often the notion of causation is invoked to explain connections. I mean, what's problematic about this, of course, is that it's not clear in many cases that you do want the notion of causation. You might be much better off with the notion of reasons or grounds or intentionality. But because you're committed to a causal, integrative, reductive model of science, and of course causation turns up, because one of the things that is true, like reductionism, is causation is a properly scientific word. So if we want, so for a lot of people, if they want to be properly scientific, they need to involve both reduction and causation. So what else is important about being Wittgensteinian scientific? So I'm suggesting that a further element is that we need a proper understanding of the nature and status of the claims of psychology and cognitive science. And again, this leads directly back into Wittgenstein's remarks on the philosophy of psychology and the idea of the difficulties of psychology not just being that it's a young science, but there are, and in that sense, being clear about psychology is very important for being clear about cognitive science, because clearly a large element of cognitive science is taken from psychology, and if we have mistaken views about what psychology is or what it can do, then that will also end up affecting cognitive science. So what can we do in terms of a positive agenda? I suggest that what we should do with what we should try and do is rewrite theories in the cognitive science of religion so they can be operationalised, that is, tested. So in other words, what we want to do is to take some of these theories and replace the metaphysics with some kind of a learning theory, so that when we have these kind of explanations, what we do is, where we find metaphysics, we ask ourselves, can we operationalise, can we test this in some way? And ideally, can we replace it with a learning theory? Because if we can replace it with some kind of a learning theory, this gives us some way of testing or checking it. The whole point is, metaphysics is not testable, it's not checkable. One thing I should like to say here, when I say about operationalisation and testing, I don't mean anything too specific here. I mean simply by this, the idea that you could put some empirical data against it and form some view about whether something is or is not the case. I mean, the only line, the distinction I want to draw here is between that and metaphysics, which in principle is not testable at all. I do think with many theories in the cognitive science of religion, many can be rewritten so that you end up replacing metaphysics with learning theories. But for some of them, such a rewriting will collapse the theory entirely because some of the claims about metaphysics, and particularly privacy, lie at the heart of them. But in one sense, that's not a conclusion we should worry about too much, because the empirical data is still valid, and we can reconstruct the theories using those data. So. What I'd like to say now is something about philosophical naturalism. Now, another thing that's very popular in cognitive science of religion theories is a commitment to philosophical naturalism. And again, I think the motivation is very similar to the interest in reduction and causation. But again, if you want to be properly scientific, then you ought to be committed to philosophical naturalism. So you do find that that's common. What I'd like to talk about is the consequences of philosophical naturalism for an account of meaning and symbolisation. And I'll say something about that a bit later. Now, philosophical naturalism does presuppose a number of difficulties. And one of the problems is that philosophical naturalism, at least as it's represented in the cognitive science of religion, tends to ally very heavily with natural science. And then this leads us back into problems we've already mentioned about explaining the social and collective character of religion. Many cognitive science and religion theories subscribe to problematic philosophical assumptions. A major one is the idea of private language and associated concepts such as the intelligibility of private mental objects. Now, when I say this, I'm not claiming that when you go and look at the theories, you're going to find any statement like private language is a good thing, we all ought to believe it. But what you will find is reference to a number of philosophical concepts, such as, you know, externalism or the extended mind, all of which are fundamentally reliant on the idea of privacy and only intelligible in those terms. So it is possible to trace it back to that root. So I'm often here as schematic. How one might think about such things. Now, there are a number of theories that do it, but I mean one prominent example is the work of Harvey Whitehouse, who propagates the idea of these of modules in the mind. Now, what it turns out is that these modules, have some similar to modules. The idea of modules in the mind propagated in philosophy, and again, you know, that's reliant on privacy. And then you've got other people who think similar things. You've got Pascal Boyer. And Bob McCauley. Then you've got Pascal Boyer and Bob McCauley, both of whom, you know, have got an interest in reduction, and part of the whole agenda is reducing things and expressing them in terms of individual cognitive processes and so on. The details of how these theories rely on such assumptions will not be discussed here, and instead the emphasis will be upon general strategies for identifying cases of this sort. So what I want to do is suggest some ways of identifying these, you know, root mistaken assumptions. And again, that's a very Wittgensteinian sort of thing, that we need to trace and find the root of philosophical error. So I want to talk about an idea which is very familiar to Wittgensteinian, which is patterns of thinking. How is it possible to recognise that these theories in the cognitive science of religion endorse problematic philosophical assumptions? Wittgenstein's idea of understanding patterns of argument, such as Cartesianism, is useful here. The aim is to identify the root from which the various errors stem from. So it's the classic Wittgensteinian idea of trying to identify root errors. Many cognitive science of religion theories have the following problems. The manifold difficulties connected with the commitment to private language and associated conceptual frameworks. Ideas about the privacy of meaning are allied to these perspectives. And an important problem is that of accounting for intersubjectivity. So this ties back to what I was originally saying about the connections between methodology and meaning. The thing is, as we know from Wittgenstein's work, if you start being committed to privacy in a fundamental way, you're going to end up being committed to the privacy of meaning. And that starts to, of course, generate all sorts of difficulties with explaining social meaning. Your other problem, of course, if you are fundamentally committed to the privacy of meaning, is you're going to have the problem of the difficulty of accounting for intersubjectivity. I mean, how is it that intersubjectivity is possible if we have private meanings? And obviously in the case of religion, that's a huge problem, because, I mean, clearly what is fundamental in religion is there is a huge amount of intersubjectivity. In terms of thinking about the problems which many cognitive science and religion theories have, another problematic pattern of thinking is that the social aspects of meaning are removed and then reintroduced, often in ways that are complicated and not particularly persuasive. What happens with many theories is that because of the wish to be properly scientific, you get, you know, all these ideas about explanation in terms of individual cognitive processes, reduction, and all the other stuff we've talked about. And what that then does is it removes the social aspects of meaning. Then, of course, the problem becomes, well, once you've effectively decided meaning is private and the social aspect of meaning has disappeared, you're then left with the difficulty of explaining how it is, since religion is essentially a social and collective activity, what sort of, you know, what do we do with social meaning? How do we explain it? And what does it have to do with religion? So what then happens is that the social aspects of meaning of it are reintroduced, and often there are quite complicated mechanisms for doing that, when in point of fact what should have happened is they shouldn't have been taken out in the first place. And when they've actually been introduced, it's still not clear that they fully explain religion, particularly rituals. Now, what I mean by this latter point is that it seems fundamental to the explanation of much religion, particularly rituals, that they do have a social dimension. And it doesn't really seem to be enough to say, well, we could explain things in terms of individual cognitive processes, and then we explain how these individual cognitive processes come together to generate social meaning. That doesn't seem right, because a ritual, if it's going to have any sense, it's got to have some fundamentally social dimension. Because even if you're doing a ritual on your own, for it to be a proper ritual in a religious sense, it's got to have some wider collective social and cultural context. Otherwise, arguably, it's not a ritual, and it's just a particular piece of, you know, routine or formalised behaviour. I mean, you could argue otherwise, but I think if you are to reflect the definition of the word ritual, that is the case. So, The third pattern of thinking, which I think is problematic, is that in many theories in the cognitive science of religion, metaphysics and armchair psychology are involved under the guise of being a scientific theory and or orientation. Now, we've discussed that already, but the consequence, as I've already suggested, is that such theories lack genuine explanatory power. So, what I should suggest happens in a number of these cases is that we end up with not with proper explanations, but with pseudo-explanations, things that appear to be explanations, but are not genuinely explanatory. So, meaning the problems of criticism. So I want to say a little bit more about methodology and meaning and what privacy might have to do with meaning. So one of the things I want to say something about is how accounts of meaning and symbolisation, it depends on certain assumptions in the philosophy of mind, especially the private language. We've mentioned that already, that if you're strongly committed to privacy, then this heads in the direction of thinking about meaning as private. Now, I also want to explore what the consequences of dropping such assumptions would be. I mean, again, as we've suggested, this would mean that many theories in the cognitive science of religion need rewriting, and some in point of fact would have to be discarded entirely. Since we're in good Wittgensteinian company, I'm not going to dwell on Wittgenstein's argument for why private language is misguided. I mean, whether you agree with this or not, I take it this is very familiar territory. All I shall say here is that it is frequently conjoined with ideas such as mental content and mental causation. And again, we know from Wittgenstein what's wrong with such ideas about mental content and about causation, and also how we should reasonably distinguish causes from reasons. So be that as it may. So what I want to do now is to move from the critique to offering some positive alternatives. So suppose that we're right in thinking that we need to drop privacy and all the associated concepts. What are the consequences for the kind of philosophical theory of meaning which should be sought? So in other words, what is the constructive alternative here? What I'd like to do is talk about Wittgenstein and meaning as social. What I think we need to do is to develop an appropriate philosophical account of meaning and symbolisation for the cognitive science of religion. Wittgenstein's later philosophy of language can be used as a basis for developing an account of meaning and symbolisation that explains the communal and collective character of religion adequately. Without such an explanation, the communal aspect of religious cognition, such as rituals, including their propagation and transfer, cannot be satisfactorily accounted for. Now, you see, this point about rituals is important, because one of the things that we need that is a focus of attention in the cognitive science of religion is how religious beliefs are propagated and transferred. I mean, how are they spread? How do they replicate? Now, I would say that if you don't have a good account of the communal aspects of religious cognition, it's extremely difficult to explain properly how rituals propagate and transfer, because if all your models are to do with individual cognition, what is the space of social meaning in which we understand rituals and people learn them, they replicate them, they propagate them? Now, I should suggest that Wittgenstein's approach to meaning fits much, much better with the empirical data about the social aspects of meaning, such as that about the processes of cultural transmission. So what I want to say here is that far from Wittgenstein being anti-scientific, I should suggest a Wittgensteinian approach to social meaning fits very well with the data that we do have. And that if you actually look at data on the processes of cultural transmission, and, you know, the transmission of virtual to another thing. This fits directly with a victim's in an account in a way that it works well. Now, I want now to start to try and flesh out what this might mean in terms of thinking about victims finding meaning as social. And some of this thinking has come from discussions at the conference at Art House, particularly with Chris Sinner and Merlin Donald. So the first issue I want to address is about normativity and how it's acquired. Now, the notion of normativity we're interested in here is what we would think of as normative cognition. That is to say, how is it the case that people project their own views of the world onto it, and how is it that we share particular kinds of cognitive norms? Now, what I mean by that is, if you take an example, say, like the perception, say, of cave paintings in Nepal, there are these caves with religious paintings on the wall, and what happens is that people come and they see religious images in these paintings, and what they're doing to a certain extent is projecting their own religious beliefs and values and views onto their perceptions of what they see. And that's clearly a case where what they think about what ought to be cognitive of the case is actually being projected outwards. And this is what I'm talking about with normative cognition. So it's those ideas. One of the things we want to know is how normative cognition is acquired. How do we project what we think out onto the world, and how is it that we come to pick up these shared cognitive norms? Now, again, this is clearly very important because, I mean, one thing that is clear about religion is religion involves shared cognitive norms. It must do. So, what I shall suggest is that when we think about normative cognition, that it's really got three elements. It's got social meaning, cognitive governance, and social facts. And what I wanted to talk about is how social meaning relates to cognitive governance and social facts. Now, the view of cognitive governance I'm interested in is one that's been propagated by Merlin Donald. And what I think Merlin Donald says is of interest, he says that cognitive governance stems from the idea of mimesis. And what Merlin means by that is the idea that we as humans have some kind of an imitative capacity, and that this ability to imitate and to memorise is the foundation of us being able to develop and regulate our cognitive processes. And in that sense, to develop shared norms of cognition with other people. So in other words, shared norms of cognition with other people stem from our ability to imitate. The other idea I want to mention here is one that's been discussed in an interesting way by Chris Sinner, which is the whole idea of social facts. The idea of social facts stems from Durkheim, but it does seem to be the case that there are social facts, and they again seem to play an important role in cognitive governance and normative cognition. Now, the idea of social facts does require some clarification, because we need to clarify their ontological and epistemological status. This is a very non-trivial problem, because we need to have a sufficiently rich definition of social fact for it to be useful. But at the same time, we don't want to end up in a situation of reification. So there is still work to be done in those areas. And whatever articulation of the social pact we do have, we've got to find one which fits appropriately with this idea of cognitive governance and normative cognition. These all have to fit together appropriately. So I suggest that the issue we need to address is the problem of connecting cognitive governance and social facts. And what we need to do, I think, is develop a suitable framework for doing this. One suggestion that's been offered is forms of life. And as we know, Wittgenstein distinguishes between biological and cultural forms of life. I think forms of life is a suggestive notion, but it requires substantial filling out to be really useful in explaining how cognitive governance and social facts are related. One way of exploring this would be to think about communities of language users and of practice. I don't want to say too much about that here because I want to discuss another alternative, but I think forms of life does require significant work. Simply because it's vaguely articulated in Wittgenstein, you would have to say a good deal about how communities have, about how language is related to practice, if you want to go anywhere in the direction of explaining how cognitive governance and social facts might be allied together. Now, before I move on to the last part of the talk, which is, I think, my preferred explanatory framework for this, simply want to recap about why cognitive governance and social facts matter for the cognitive science of religion. I mean, as we've said, religion is fundamentally a social and collective practice. So we really need to know how people acquire norms about what they ought to think, how they project what they ought to think onto the world. Those are really important, those are fundamental. The other thing, of course, is if religion is a social and collective activity, social facts do seem to be central to the understanding of religion, and particularly ritual. Mm-hmm. And we cannot really make sense of those without an appropriate notion of social facts. So what I'm suggesting is that this is a better way of thinking about things, because it explains the data, and it also has the great benefit that instead of invoking metaphysics from a philosophy of mind, it is invoking hard data from psychology and, you know, neuropsychology. So in that sense, that clearly is much more the direction we should be moving for explanations. So for this final section, I want to say, well, if this is where we should be going, what kind of a philosophical theory do we need? And I'm going to suggest that Wittgenstein's idea of world pictures might be a good place to start from. So as we know, Wittgenstein says that knowledge consists of a core of propositions that form the base of inquiry, which is surrounded by empirical propositions that are consequences of investigation. Core propositions constitute our world picture. They are not explicitly learned. Now one idea I want to suggest here is, when Wittgenstein says they're not explicitly learned, I wonder if you might be able to introduce the idea of mimesis to explain this cognitive governance. So, I mean, how is it that we, you know, learn these, how do we acquire these particular types of world picture, although they're not explicitly learned? I mean, perhaps this whole idea of, you know, acquiring things by imitation might explain how some of this is picked up. And I think that that again serves a useful role because that ties the philosophy into the empirical data. The world picture provides a context for meaningful knowledge claims. So, the other point I want to make is that cognitive science theories about the transmission of culture can supplement Wittgenstein's ideas on the acquisition and transformation of beliefs in world pictures. Now, I mean, when Wittgenstein talks about world pictures, he talks a lot about how we acquire them, how they're transformed, but he doesn't say too much about the mechanisms that are involved. But I shall suggest that since cognitive science theories about the transmission of culture explain how different kinds of cultural representation can be propagated and transferred, these fit quite usefully into that framework, because it starts to explain how changes might occur in world pictures. In other words, how cultures might be modified and transformed. And the advantage of that type of explanation from a Wittgenstein perspective is that although you have some individual elements in these theories, very much of these theories are concerned with the social dimensions of cultural propagation, and as a result they're reasonably appropriate, and I think that's an area that is worth further investigation. I'll just say a little bit more about world pictures. I should suggest that world pictures include social facts. That the given social facts we have are part of world pictures. What I think is of interest is the particular status, if any, which social facts have within world pictures. I'm not sure at this stage I've entirely made my mind up or whether it makes sense to assign them to a social category or a special category, or perhaps whether what's needed is just to explain them in a particular way. But again, I think that's an area worthy of investigation. So what we do know about world pictures is a world picture is a system of propositions that support one another, and almost every proposition can be revised. Again, we've got Wittgenstein's familiar metaphor of the bed, world pictures, and the water's empirical proposition of a river. And a core proposition may take on the role of an empirical one, or, and vice versa. Now, the point of thinking about that in those ways is that I think that, again, that fits quite nicely with the idea of social facts, because a social fact might at one time be something effectively which you've not even sort of consciously aware of. And then on other occasions, it might be something that you actually take on and think about as an empirical proposition. The reason I say that is that you can see evidence of this when you visit other cultures, because within your own culture, probably many of your social facts are world picture propositions which you don't think about. Then when you go to another culture, you have to take on different norms and ideas. So at some point when you do that, you may end up learning a new social fact, which in effect for you is an empirical proposition. And when you spend long enough in that culture, what was once an empirical proposition once again becomes becomes part of your world picture. So I'm suggesting that if you include social facts in world pictures, that is consistent with what we know about them and with what we can explain about them. And finally, just a note on incommensurability. So certain world picture propositions could not be rejected or revised because doing so would dismantle the world picture. Different world pictures are closer and less closer to the truth. That's one of the things Wittgenstein claims. He also says that sufficiently different world pictures can be incommensurable, so only persuasion to see the world in another way is possible. Now, the reason for sort of closing on this note is that if we think about religion as a social and collective phenomena, and we also think about it in terms of cognitive governance and social facts, one of the things we do know is that unfortunately many religious beliefs are incommensurable. And I shall suggest again that this sort of way of thinking about things explains the data that we do know about how people view other religions and other religious practices, because incommensurability is a big problem. So Wittgenstein suggests that you know, the only way of getting someone to see another world picture is in terms of persuasion. However, I should suggest that persuasion can be allied to psychological hermeneutics, and that engaging, that intercultural engagement may also have the same effect as persuasion in terms of getting people to see the world in a different way. So what I'd really like to do to conclude is to suggest that if we want to make progress in the cognitive science of religion, we need firstly to think very carefully about the commitments to methodology and meaning that there are in many of the existing theories, and where we find examples of privity and other unsatisfactory kinds of metaphysics to eradicate those, and then in terms of developing a more constructive account of the social and collective aspects of religion, that we think about important ideas from psychology like cognitive governments and social facts, and we use those to explain the aspects of normativity in religion which we know to be the case. And I've suggested that I think Wittgenstein's idea of world pictures fits quite nicely as a framework for that, and we use that in conjunction with Wittgenstein's ideas about social meaning to start to begin to develop other accounts in which the full value of the empirical work in the cognitive science of religion is appreciated. Thank you.